If there is an all-powerful and loving God in this world, why is there so much excruciating pain and unspeakable suffering? The problem of suffering has haunted me for a very long time. It was what made me begin to think about religion when I was young, and it was what led me to question my faith when I was older. Ultimately, it was the reason I lost my faith.
This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
So I guess that leads us to the actual subject of the podcast, the problem of evil. Scott, you wanted to go over theodicy in general. Did you want to take it from there?
No, I didn't want to go over theodicy in general. I just kind of want to just summarize the idea of the problem of evil, just itself. Okay?
Go for it.
This is going to be rather simplistic just for time's sake, but... The traditional notion of God being omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent, or all good, all knowing, and all powerful, that kind of is, you know, the three walls of this issue. So if there are things in the world that cause suffering, or if there's suffering, if there's pain, disease, death. You know, all of these awful things that humanity has to endure.
Injustice.
I mean, there's you know, natural disasters, just, you know, pain, birth defects. I mean, there's so many kinds of things here. And if you want to get a better idea, a really humorous idea of where this conversation starts, go and watch the first episode of Mr. Deity called Mr. Deity and the Evil.
We really should wrap up the whole evil thing. Sir? Mr. Deity, what you're allowing, what you're not allowing.
Okay, where were we?
Well, we last left off. We had decided, well, actually, you had decided, sir, that you weren't going to allow people to harm each other with merely their thoughts.
Their thoughts, yeah, that's good. That's good.
Right, next up, kind of a biggie, holocausts.
Yeah, I'm going to allow it.
Okay, holocausts in. Next up, torture. Broad brush here. You got men, women, children, animals.
Babies?
Babies, yes.
Yeah, I'm going to leave it in.
Okay, torture's in. Sir, you are all-powerful, right?
What is it?
I was just thinking, because the list... It was just... okay, moving down the list, sir. Down syndrome.
What is it? It's
a birth defect. Causes a mental retardation. Has the certain morphological consequence.
Oh, yeah, that's awful. It's so sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's leave it in.
Okay. Down syndrome. In. Well, the next one, I checked with the boys down in research on this. Said we're safe to leave it out.
What is it?
That natural disaster complement. The earthquakes, floods, tsunamis.
Yeah, I need to have that in.
Well, sir, I actually spoke with the head of R&D myself on this one. Sir, I spoke with the head of R&D, okay? He said if we leave this out, it's not going to affect anybody's free will or natural law or anything like that. And since you're way over quota on the gratuitous pain and suffering...
Here's the thing. If we take it out, it's going to be way too easy for people to believe in me.
No, sir, let me go over the list. Holocausts, torture, and Down syndrome. Those three alone... make it kind of hard to believe in you.
No, I don't think so.
Sir, really, if you had the natural disasters, you got earthquakes, floods, tsunamis, you throw in a hard winter or two, no one's going to believe in you.
Sure they will.
Sir, I really don't think they will.
For how much? I'll bet you a C-note and I'll make you Archangel if I'm wrong.
But sir, I don't want to wager with you.
Yeah, because you know you're wrong.
No, because I know you're the God of the universe, the all-knowing God. You can see the future. All is present with you.
Okay, that's a good point. That's fair. 10 to 1?
Sir, please don't insult my intelligence.
101?
101. You're on.
Okay.
So is that it? Can we go, or is...
No, not even close. Conjoined twins.
We're going to be here all night. Yeah. Yeah, leave it.
Okay, conjoined twins. Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah, leave it in.
Okay, leave it in.
Oh, but wait for Lou.
Wait for Lou. Makes sense. I assume you have no problem with childhood cancer.
No.
Celine Dion.
If God is loving and he's able and he knows about our suffering, then why is the suffering still there? That's the gist of it. Did anybody else have anything they want to add?
I'd want to add something about it. I mean, the problem of evil really comes up when it comes to the notion of gratuitous suffering. It isn't just the fact that there's evil. It's the fact that it's so extensive, brutal, unremitting. So much of it is clearly pointless, or it seems to be clearly pointless. And it's sort of that enormous excess that turns it into a pressing problem. And so being able to press that makes it so that it, you know, it becomes more difficult to say, well, there's free will or blah, 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 because really the crux here is the problem of meaningless suffering when it comes to the problem of evil.
Randy, you mentioned theodicies, so we're gonna talk about different explanations for this problem of evil. But Jimmy was, you know, referring to some of them there, basically that, you know, people will say, oh, well, suffering is for your own good. You know, maybe suffering can teach you things. So, okay, that's true for some suffering, perhaps. Like maybe it's good that you burn your hand if you touch something hot, but it's not necessarily good that, you know, a tsunami kills 200,000 people who happen to be on the wrong coastline at the wrong time in history. Okay. So distinguishing something like that. So how do we want to attack it in terms of going from there? Do we want to go through the book outline that you had, or what direction did you want to go, Randy?
Well, I think Mike has something to say. If I heard
that.
Yeah. Properly.
Yeah. That was me.
So I'm going to let Mike respond to Jimmy, but you know, because really what the book only deals with how the Bible deals with suffering. And so I think we can go through that, and I think some of these other things will come up in the course of the conversation. But Mike, go ahead and give your response.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to establish the criteria that we judge evil from in the first place, because I know David and I are coming from a Christian perspective, and so we're going to probably be aligned on that criteria. But I ask the three of you, from an atheistic perspective, how do you judge some things being evil over other things not being evil?
So I didn't think that I used the word evil in what I was describing in terms of things that are in the world. So to me, evil is a lot more of a subjective question. I'm just saying I don't have to get into what's evil or not to talk about the problem of, you know, the title of the book here that we have, God's problem, or what people call the problem of evil. I'm characterizing that in the context of pain and suffering, misery, that conscious creatures can experience those, you know, emotions or that state of consciousness, that state, and as Jimmy pointed out, that state to, you know, a certain degree, being pushed past a certain limit, I think the more that happens, the worse that it is, or the less justifiable that it is if it serves no end to it, if it's gratuitous. Okay, so I define it briefly as the suffering of conscious creatures. I'm going with the Sam Harris.
Okay, so you're talking about suffering, psychological and physiological suffering?
Well, let me say at least what I think. I'm really close to what Scott was saying. But, I mean, one of the things is that it's really the sort of stuff that we don't need criteria for. We can just have instances of that I think everyone here is going to agree on, right? I mean, you know, a baby suffering and just horrible torture until it, you know, starves to death during being exposed, you know, to the elements would be an example. The Holocaust or the Shoah would be another example. The Khmer Rouge and, you know, the millions of deaths and just tremendous unimaginable suffering going on there. I mean, I think that, you know, we don't have to come to some sort of agreement on like the specific criteria of what evil is in this problem of evil, to see that those things are problems for the idea of a God that actively intervenes in the world and cares about his creatures.
Maybe you're thinking, you know, different categorizations of evil. You know, Leibniz generally, you know, divided evil into three kinds: metaphysical, moral, and natural. Is that what you're referring to?
I'm just saying we don't need to do all
that. No,
no,
I was referring to what Mike said.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, just because when you talk, when you have these types of discussions, of course, if I'm sitting down with Christian friends, I come from an absolute morality viewpoint that's Judeo-Christian in nature. And I found that a lot of my atheist friends have to borrow our Judeo-Christian viewpoint of what is good and evil in order to have a reference point in the discussion. Otherwise, it's cultural in nature. What's good and evil, or what's suffering and not suffering, actually does vary as you go around the seven continents.
I don't know who you've talked to. But, you know, like my background, you know, and my training is all in philosophy and literature, but mainly philosophy. That was my grad work. And, you know, professionally speaking, all of the people that I talk to pretty much can agree, and they draw on the philosophical tradition, they draw on Buddhism, whatever it is. Almost anyone who's worth talking to about this on this issue will agree that the Khmer Rouge caused a lot of just horrible, horrible, if you want to call it evil. You know, you don't really need to, have some sort of sturdy metaphysics in place to understand that that's evil. That's one of the facts that any metaphysics you have has to take account of, right? So,
well, and I think just colloquially, we're using the word evil as the way that we characterize a behavior that, or an action that someone takes, right? We would say, oh, well, that's evil. And so I don't need to put a moral tag on whatever God is doing or not doing. I'm just saying, if the universe exists in a certain manner such that God could do something about it and then chooses not to, and yet we're supposed to think that he's loving, that's a contradiction. Okay. So I don't need to characterize his behavior in any certain way to have that contradiction still stand up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and you don't need the Judeo-Christian starting point or platform to describe objective suffering, like starving to death. I mean, how does the Judeo-Christian tradition have some kind of insight on that?
Sure.
Eight million children a year starve to death. My mom starved to death because of tumors. Tumors took all of her nutrients. She starved to death. She was in excruciating pain. And that's just objective suffering. Evil, let's just replace the word evil with gratuitous suffering.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. So, getting to Bart Ehrman's book, the first tradition he brings up is the prophetic tradition. Some of the books, you guys have my outline, Isaiah, Amos, Hosea, Jonah, etc.
Can we, before we dig in,
yeah,
can I just kind of give my synopsis for anybody who hasn't read the book? Basically what Ehrman is doing is he's basically saying, he's looking at the problem of evil and trying to describe how different veins of thought within the Bible approach it. And so the different theodicies or the different explanations that they have, and they vary and they contradict, or they're non overlapping. They're somewhat mutually exclusive on some accounts. So he goes through basically, but Ehrman's book isn't really like an exhaustive philosophical approach. He's going textual approach. Wouldn't you say? Like, he's very centered on the biblical text and how the biblical text
tries to
answer these problems.
Yeah, he's not addressing the problem of evil in general, just how the Bible tends to approach what we would call the problem of evil.
Right. Okay. So sorry to cut you off there, Randy. I just wanted to.
So, Scott, I would definitely agree with you that it's not an exhaustive philosophical approach to theodicy. That's not really the book's aim. The book's aim is just let's look at the Bible and how it deals with suffering. And you got all these different traditions. But the problem of evil as it pertains to, you know, whether or not God exists, Jimmy, you and I were talking about this earlier today. You said it doesn't really come up until about the time of Voltaire and Leibniz.
Well, no, it comes up for the Greeks and Epicurus, you know, back in the day. But the thing is that the Bible doesn't have any sense of there being a problem of evil that could place God into question, right? There's no need to justify God to human beings, you know, as some sort of, you know, does God exist? Is it possible for there to be a God if these things are present in the universe that he supposedly created, right? And so one of the reasons the Bible doesn't address the problem of evil is that it just simply doesn't arise. I mean, the assumption is that he exists and suffering exists and, you know, let's try to account for it, or not let's try to account for it. This is how we account for it.
Excellent. So the prophetic tradition, and that's the one I think Mormons are most familiar with, because Joseph plagiarizes much of Second Isaiah, Isaiah before 600, the Isaiah after 600.
Yeah, I would actually disagree a little bit there, because from my experience, Mormons, you ask them, you know, what do the prophets say? You're going to get a blank stare. They're not going to talk about social justice. They're not going to talk about, you know, this pushing for, you know, feeding the widows. I mean, sorry, taking care of the widows, the orphans, you know, kind of this railing against the authority, you know, which in that time would have been the king. I think most Mormons are like, well, you know, they just shoot out, what is it, Amos 3:7, you know, God talks to prophets, you know, end of story. Anyway, that's an aside.
Randy, you're talking more about the doctrinal construct of the consequence of suffering is violating the covenant of God. I mean, that's the Doctrine and Covenants.
Yeah, and you know, much of Second Nephi, I mean, it's right in there.
Right.
Word for word, you know, errors and all. And you see this with Mormonism. They really believe in a meritocracy. You know, the gospel of what's that called, Scott?
The prosperity gospel.
Yeah, the prosperity gospel.
Sure.
That sin leads to suffering and misfortune, and righteousness leads to prosperity and happiness. And you see it when they have that narrative, when loved ones leave the church, of course they're going to be miserable, right? Because that's the consequences. That's the wages of sin. Maybe
it's the Book of Mormon. It's the Book of Mormon pride cycle.
Exactly. Like
that's what they talk about over and over again.
It's so black and white in the Book of Mormon. When the Nephites are righteous, they prosper. When they're wicked, they get destroyed over and over until they're finally ultimately destroyed 1,000 years later. But the prophet tradition is that suffering is a consequence of sin. You're violating a covenant with God. And so this suffering is directly at the hand of God, is it not? Like, this is God causing suffering.
Yeah.
From my perspective, no, it's not God being the agent of the suffering. It's God allowing the suffering in this micro experience. Because I want to make it clear as we go through each of these things, my perspective is not that there's one silver bullet answer from the Bible that answers the global problem of suffering. I think that this is one of the answers to a very specific case, specifically in the Old Testament, with these prophets speaking to these people with specific promises, teaching a lesson that if you violate these specific promises, then in essence, you are cutting yourself off from the protection that I would have to offer. And so I think it's just a specific experience. It doesn't explain all suffering. It can explain some of these people's suffering that these particular prophets are speaking to.
That's something that Ehrman would agree with, but I think that it's pretty clear from the Bible, and he'd disagree with you on this, that God is pretty much the agent of this suffering. And there are precursors to the prophets in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, for example. And if you look like in the book of Ezekiel, which is one of the prophets, he explains why Sodom got destroyed by God. And it's exactly the sort of stuff that you'd expect. It wasn't sex. It was pride, too much food, prosperous ease. They didn't help the poor, the needy. They were haughty and all that sort of stuff. And it wasn't just sort of God's withholding his protection. He just actively destroyed them. He decimated them.
Yeah, and I think there's plenty of corollaries in the Mormon context. I mean, in the Book of Mormon, you know, God cursing people's skin or having their own society be protected, you know, in war, in times of warfare. I mean, pretty direct involvement of God punishing and rewarding based on the behaviors of people.
Well, and then if you want to talk about withholding protection, I mean, think of the siege by the Babylonians of Jerusalem. I mean, what he was doing was passively standing back, if you want to look at that interpretation, and allowing people to starve to the point where they're eating their own children, as Jeremiah, you know, talks about in the book of Jeremiah. So even if he's standing back and letting them face the consequences because they've been evil, you know, it's not the sort of standing back that I think a benevolent deity would do. So there is a response to the problem of suffering here. There is an account of it, but it doesn't seem to be the kind that most of us would be comfortable with.
And is there really, yeah, is there really a difference? I mean, if I'm right, sitting on the edge of my pool and I see my child is drowning and I have every opportunity and capability of pulling them out and I just watch them drown, what's the
especially
difference?
And Randy, imagine you're justifiably pissed at them because they really, really treated one of your fellow, you know, one of their siblings horribly. You know, do you let them drown? You know, disproportionate punishment, but they did do something wrong.
Yeah. So you're saying, what's the difference between letting them drown when you could just lift, you know, extend your finger or something, versus holding them down with your hand, like? I mean, what
same,
morally
same
is there
result.
A difference?
Yeah. Sure. I see what you're saying, but Randy, first of all, I mean, obviously, there's a big difference between you and God, unless you have something to share with us. But there,
well, yeah, he's not as evil.
I mean, yeah, I'm definitely
have the power to inflict so much suffering on his children.
I'm definitely kinder to my children.
Well, and we can talk about that, but let's focus on this particular issue, because you make a really good point from a finite perspective. But hand in hand with a faith in God is a faith in an afterlife. And so if there's an afterlife, then, you know, unlike your scenario with your allowing your son to drown in your swimming pool because, you know, he deserved it because he was disobeying you, that from a finite perspective is allowing him to be completely extinguished and non-existent from your perspective. But if you're a sovereign God and you allow mortal death to happen and you have that vantage point of knowing that there is something else to learn, it's kind of like us being angry because we planted an apple seed in the ground and a year later, it didn't produce any apples, so we chopped it down and said, this is a terrible apple tree. Well, we didn't give a chance to let it go through all the process. I feel like we're jumping the gun. And
so you're comparing being forced to to eat your own children after they've died in a horrible, horrible, horrible siege to this sort of, like, you know, getting ready for something better in the future. I mean, obviously God could create that better future without having to force people to undergo severe and extensive torture. I mean, this is where, for example, there are some Christians, Ehrman mentions two of them, who have said, look, we're better off as Christians just not talking about this stuff because we end up saying horrible things. Like, you know, the suffering of these children is something that's for a better good and it'll be redeemed in the end. And we
can I address that real quick? Because I'm not one of those people. You know, I work in the inner city of Dallas. I don't have to go to Africa. My job is in the inner city of Dallas. I work with people in terrible, generationally terrible conditions, who grew up on the streets, grew up in the hood and gangs. Some of the stories I could share with you that I hear firsthand, they're awful. And I would never minimize it at all. That's why I actually don't resonate with a typical evangelical Christian who has some sort of dogmatic response to the problem of suffering. It's a big problem. So I don't minimize that. And I don't believe in a God who minimizes that. I believe in a God who weeps. In other words, I believe in a God who came himself to this earth and experienced it all so that he is right there after the death of the terrible, horrible suffering to succor his people in a way that they can say, hey, I get it. I understand.
That's the sort of behavior that, you know, this loving, weeping God should also probably be, you know, incarcerated. I mean, you know, if you did that on the streets of, you know, the inner city, you know, letting a child starve to death as you watched it be neglected, you know, weeping all along, that would be considered horrible misbehavior. And I'm not meaning to question your love for the people that you serve or anything like that. I'm just saying it's kind of interesting how people end up getting backed into a corner trying to explain this stuff. And people of very, very goodwill and lots of love end up justifying God weeping as he does not, you know, let a kid survive and then forces a parent to eat the kid.
Well, it's because the two of us come from a different presupposition. Your presupposition is this life is all that we have, and my presupposition is that an all powerful God who is all loving and who knows everything that we don't know is going to be there to succor that child. And it doesn't minimize my responsibility to succor the child. In fact, Jesus makes that clear in the New Testament. If you read what he cares about how we're treating people now. He wants us to minimize the suffering. And yeah. To me, that's what he's trying to help us understand that, you know, hey, when you meet me again, I'm going to care more about, you know, it's the whole narrative. When I was naked, did you clothe me? When I was hungry, did you feed me? So Jesus clearly cares about us minimizing that suffering as much as we possibly can. And, you know, and then when that, and this leads into some of the other issues that we haven't talked about yet. But,
well, let me say, there's just two things I want to say there. I mean, one thing is that even if there is some sort of like long-term plan here, really that long-term plan, seems to be possible without torturing babies. And if torturing babies is bad, and it's horribly bad, it's unimaginably bad, then the absence of torturing babies, even if everything's going to be supposedly made fine later, seems to be the answer. I mean, basically you're saying that God can let babies be tortured because there's an end game when that end game doesn't seem to require the torture of babies. And second of all, I just want to mention that in as much as you do it to the least of these, you do it to me, right?
Yeah.
It's really interesting. That's in Matthew 25, and it ends with, and those who didn't do it go to hell, everlasting punishment.
Right.
And so you end up with an end game that's even worse than the torture and siege of Jerusalem. And so what happens is you end up with this sort of like real uncomfortable thing that a modern Christian has to do, and that is take their goodwill and concern, their humanitarian concern for suffering, and project it back onto a Bible that really has presuppositions that you yourself as a Christian don't share.
And you make a good point, but I also believe that that's not the only aspect of the end game. I think that there are clear-cut messages of this is the type of world. Now, remember, I'm coming from the presupposition that time is a construct that we all experience, and that after we die, this is just a brief period of time, and God succors his people to the point where he makes up for all that. But we leave with this message of look what a world is like when God is when the principles of God, meaning God being love, the core aspect of love, if that is ignored, this is the type of atrocious stuff that happens. And I think that he is capable of creating that comforter, but that doesn't minimize my responsibility to try to put an end to all of that.
Well, one of the things you bring up that I want to bring up, this is one of the things I don't like about religion, and Mormonism and Christianity shares it alike, is this eternal perspective. You know, this life is only a short time, and really what matters is eternity. And that's kind of one of the justifications that you brought up earlier. And what it, you know, the unintended consequence, and you and David are very well-meaning Christians and would never stand by to watch gratuitous suffering if you could help it. But by minimizing the significance of this world, it minimizes the significance of this life. So, like, if a child suffers for 2 years and all 2 years of its existence are suffering, well, it's only 2 years. Well, does that 2 years matter? To me, yes, it does. And I think religion unintentionally minimizes that kind of suffering, even if it is for a short period of time.
Yeah, this is, I want to add a word here. The philosopher Nietzsche actually was really interesting on this, where he says that Christianity really, when it comes to its evaluation of life, is pretty nihilistic. You know, often people think that the atheism is nihilistic, but when you hear this sort of minimization of this life, you know, you imagine like 5 years of unimaginable suffering in the Holocaust, in a Jewish, you know, in Auschwitz, for example. And, you know, if you really think nihilistically about how important human life is, yeah, that's just nothing. It's a blip in eternity. If you actually care about this world and you care about that suffering, it's like one of the worst things that you can hear that's ever happened, right?
I agree with you, and I agree with the whole nihilistic viewpoint being, I actually believe that's just as atrocious as you do. And one of the things that I think coming out of Mormonism helps someone like me understand is that people like you have become atheists. It's not because you're dark-hearted people in the grasp of Satan. It's actually for a similar reason why I have become Christian. I feel like the Christianity is the answer to live every day. Jesus is the one God who didn't just say, hey, I want you to only think about the afterlife. There's a lot of religions, including Mormonism, that basically you suffer your whole life under the auspice of all of this. Everything that I'm doing is for eternity. And Jesus actually taught quite different. Him saying, I want you to succor the poor and help people and take care of people is actually the opposite message. And I understand why an atheist would have the viewpoint of, I need to live each day at its fullest because it's all I've got. And I actually appreciate that viewpoint, but I can have that exact same viewpoint and be following Christ verbatim according to what you see in the New Testament. I mean, that's what he cared most about. That's what he fought against when he fought against the Pharisees and the legalistic notion and really just planning for the eternity. Jesus was the opposite of that.
Mike, let me ask you this question then. So do you believe, like, as part of your Christian theology, that there are eternal consequences for the way that we live here on earth? And what I mean by that is there, you know, basically that judgment for eternity is based on what we do in mortality?
No.
No. Okay, so what determines, you know, our afterlife?
I think for me, I found it on the narrative in 1 John that talks about God is love. And then I go back to 1 Samuel 16:7, seeing the manifestation of that, where he says, man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. I think at the end of the day, that is what is going to matter to him the most. And when you have that viewpoint, I tend to be a little more of a universalist because of that. And I also don't view this construct of like an eternal location of hell that people burn in forever because they couldn't understand a few things while they were in mortality. I don't believe in that.
So you don't think that people are punished after death for believing the wrong things or for having, you know, acting a certain way? Like, there's no eternal punishment for that?
I think the eternal punishment comes based upon the motivation. I think motivation matters because, once again, it goes back to God.
But again,
is love,
I'm getting at motivation here on earth. I'm saying so you don't get to change your mind after the fact. It's based on what happens here in your life, right?
No, because I don't think it's based upon all the details of what happens in your life, because I believe that God is perfectly just. And justice would not allow for someone that you know, found a reasonable reason to reject what they saw. But as soon as God explains it all, they're like, oh, okay, that makes sense to me. I'll embrace this. I don't think that God would have any issue from a place of love and a place of justice. To me, it's much more in line with an omniscient, omnipotent, all-loving
God. That's almost the Mormon view on it, then, basically. You're saying that...
No.
I'm confused then, because it sounds pretty Mormon to have kind of like a universalistic view, like there's not really a hell, and that
God's
gonna...
that's actually a false construct of Mormonism. If you really look at the Mormon doctrine, anything but the highest degree of the celestial kingdom really is in reality a hell from most Mormons' perspective.
Let me jump in and defend Mike here, at least in terms of traditional Christianity. Now, I do believe that it's straight out not clear from the scriptures. I mean, look, we talked about Matthew 25. You don't help the poor and the needy, and you get everlasting punishment and all that sort of stuff. But if you go to the fathers, at least certain strands of it, like I have a friend who's a priest, Eastern Orthodox, and it's a belief amongst many people that are Eastern Orthodox that hell exists, but it's probably going to end up empty. And Origen is one of the sources of that. And even though he's not in great standing with the tradition, that particular teaching is there, that hell's real, but will be empty. And so at least that's a possibility for certain Christians that are very, very traditional.
Right.
Well, I guess the point I was trying to make is that, and I think maybe your view is non-typical for Christians, which is totally fine. And I'm not trying to box you in with something that you're not, but I guess
I appreciate your permission.
No, I'm saying I'm not giving you permission. I'm saying I wouldn't try to mischaracterize you because you claim to be a Christian, ergo you must believe certain things. Like I get that, but
right.
What I was getting at is basically if we look at the problem of evil, if you flip it around. It's the same thing in terms of an afterlife or any kind of eternal punishment is how could there be a hell or how could there be any kind of eternal punishment? Because it's going to be, by definition, infinitely disproportionate to whatever kind of action you took that would merit that.
Even with Hitler, I mean, killing...
Right.
You know, he started a war that 50 million people died. As a consequence of that war, he actively annihilated 6 million Jews. But anything he did wouldn't even justify eternal torment. The scope of that kind of suffering and pain. And I guess you don't subscribe to an eternal hell, Mike or David. David, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm alive.
Do you believe in hell, David?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know that I go as far as Origen. I do think everybody does have is given a clear choice. I do think because we do as people possess, in philosophical terms, a libertarian free will. It's open for people to choose to go there, to not accept the grace of Jesus. I don't know who said it. You know, Origen said, or the Eastern Orthodox would say it's a possibility that it's empty. I would lean towards. There's probably going to be people there just because some people are going to choose that route for whatever reason. And God's not going to take that free choice away from them.
So what is
the route? Oh, sorry, Randy. What is the route to hell? Like, what is the choice that lands you there?
To not accept the grace of Jesus. If salvation is by grace, to essentially say, no, that's, for whatever reason, decide, I don't want that gift. That's not for me. And,
And then you're tormented forever?
I don't know what hell is like. There's also the possibility of annihilationism. I don't know that I'd go that route. But yeah, I mean, when you choose to go there, I think you're going to go there eternally. And, I don't know the temperature settings in hell. I don't know the decor.
the thing that when you said annihilation, of course that reminded me of Harry Potter and the Dementors.
That is a minority view.
Sucking your soul out and it gets obliterated
Well, what it reminds me of is murder, actually. So at that point, for being mistaken, it looks like you either get killed or tortured.
I lean away from annihilationism. I just throw it out there as, you know, as one Christian option that some people do choose. So that's basically, you know, what I think hell is and, you know, why you would end up there.
And see, one caveat I would add to what David is saying is I just believe that very few people are going to be that stubborn to say I outright reject you.
So you have hope that I will eventually see the light of Jesus, and whether in this life or the next, I'll accept him.
So Randy,
I'd have to be a stubborn idiot to not accept the grace of Jesus.
So
I'm sorry. That's a loaded question.
Simplistic. To answer your question, Randy, listening to all the Infants on Thrones podcasts that have been recorded in the annals of heaven, not just in the digital world. But I would have full confidence in saying yes until I went back and listened to your Mormon Stories podcast. Or Mormon Expression, or which I don't know which one it was. I'm just kidding. No, there was one really long one I listened to you talking about your past. Was that Mormon Stories?
Yeah, that was a 6.5 hour. That was by the way, that was edited down from like 13 hours of footage.
Jeez. No, that was a really good podcast. But let me say this in all honesty, you don't strike me, Randy, from just getting to know your viewpoints, obviously, just through podcasts. You don't strike me as a person that if God were to lay out all of the answers as saying, I still reject you, I think you'd be okay with that.
But like what other answer, like why doesn't, why do we not just have the answers laid out now? Like, isn't that supposed to be what the Bible and the like religion and all of that's for, is to show that to us? Like, I don't know why we're waiting to die to get like, you know, the special features on the DVD.
Sure. Yeah. You know, Scott, that's a super valid question. And all I can say is I'm not God.
Well, I wonder if you guys would accept the possibility of someone acknowledging and responding to Christ's grace or God's grace, without really fully being aware that they're doing it. In other words, without explicit confession of the faith, right? So that there can be a sort of responsiveness that gets you out of hell that doesn't involve conviction, and profession of faith. Is that a possibility? Is that right out?
For me, yes, that's a possibility.
For me, 100%. That's part of my viewpoint. I think it's a very Mormon construct to think that you have to go through certain rituals, signs, tokens, ordinances in order to access super VIP heaven, as Jake talks about.
You got to get past the sentinels.
Yeah, I don't like all that stuff. To me, is human construct to try to create a super exclusive club. I think my faith tells me that if God really is love, we're all going to be shocked at how wrong we all were in so many areas. But then it goes back to Scott's question. That's a great question of, so why not lay it all out now? David, do you have a response to that?
A response to why God doesn't lay it out all right now?
Yeah.
Or why does he hide himself so carefully?
Now I feel like a blithering idiot because I'm on the spot and I have no.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Mike did that, not me.
Yeah, I know, David. I'm sorry.
Yeah, there actually is. That's been offered that, you know, one of the evidences against the existence of God is what they call divine hiddenness. In other words, you know, a good God. This is kind of a variant of the problem of evil, but you know what a good God would do was make it clear to those that he loved what they need to do and what they need to respond to, so as to prevent them from, you know, eternal suffering. And since we don't have that. Since reasonable people can disagree, people of goodwill can disagree, that's a reason to believe that God of a certain conception doesn't exist.
Well, since I put David on the spot, I'll put myself back on the spot to attempt to answer. I think to me, once again, it follows the construct of if God is love, if God is all-knowing, and I believe all those things, and all-powerful, then at the end of the day, when it comes to making himself 100% manifest in everything that he does, I think it gives probably a lot of people a premature opportunity to reject him for eternity. So that's the only thought I could come up with is, you know, if he's less evident, then after this life, I think the vast majority of us could say, hey, look, you did not manifest yourself very clearly to me. And as a all-loving and perfectly just God, he would say, yeah, so I'm not going to punish you for eternity. Does that make sense?
Well, then why does he have to punish anyone, especially for eternity?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if the punishment is a construct that came later. You know, if you look back at the Old Testament is very, doesn't talk much about eternal punishment as it does in the New Testament. So I don't know. I don't know. It's a good question.
The next tradition. Okay, so we cover the prophetic tradition, which in short is sin or suffering as a consequence of sin. So let's move on to the wisdom tradition. And I'm going to have Jimmy explain this because he's way more well-read than I am on the wisdom tradition. So, Jimmy, why don't you explain the wisdom tradition?
Well, I mean, Bart Ehrman just talks about it. And I mean, basically, the wisdom tradition does not originate in Israel. It's kind of a Near Eastern thing. So if you go throughout Mesopotamia, a lot of the people, it's kind of an elite thing, sought out wisdom. They had this sense that the, you know, universe was run according to the principles of wisdom, and that if you followed them, if you were wise and righteous, that you would prosper. And if you weren't righteous, that you would fail. I mean, it's straight out in the Proverbs, right? I think it's 12:20. Proverbs 12:20 just basically says it. You know, the wicked, bad things will happen to them, and the righteous, good things will happen to them. And so there's a certain sense in which, you know, justice really happens on earth. And you can tell if someone's been just based on whether they're prospering or not. And of course, the other wisdom books, include Job and Ecclesiastes, in addition to Proverbs, take up that problem. There's not like an agreement in the Bible on this exactly, but Job, for example, all of his comforters actually agree with Proverbs, essentially, that, you know, the wicked suffer and the righteous prosper. And, you know, the book of Job kind of takes up that question and takes up that issue and responds to it differently than Proverbs would. And Ecclesiastes basically says it's pretty obvious that that's not true. And basically says, you know, what we need to do if we're going to be wise is adjust to the fact that sometimes the wicked will be prospering and the righteous will be suffering. And so there's a really interesting debate, you know, internal to the Bible about, you know, the status of this wisdom tradition. And then in the book of Psalms, you end up with strands of it that kind of assume the basics of the wisdom tradition and that God will punish the wicked. All of this is against the backdrop of no assumption of any sort of afterlife.
Okay, Jimmy, what the fuck?
Is that too much?
No. Like, there's tapping and shit.
Yeah, it sounds like you have, like, whiskers that are brushing your microphone or something.
What I need to do is to be able to say it without moving my head.
It sounds better like that. Whatever you're doing right now, it sounds perfect.
What you're doing right now, do it from now on.
Well, it's incredibly uncomfortable because it means my head is completely immobile on a mobile neck.
What's the sacrifice?
Well, I will do this for Infants on Thrones. Do you want me to repeat that, or do you guys want to go to bed and just give up and cry?
I think it's horrible. I mean, we might be able to edit it in post. I don't care.
Okay. Let's move on.
Well, Mike and David, what's your response to the wisdom tradition, or do you have any?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the wisdom tradition is Israel. It is appropriating a previous wisdom tradition from Egypt, especially, and from Babylon, or from the general, you know, ancient Near East. And I think it is them trying to make sense of the fact that, you know, they no longer have control over their political destiny. They are under, you know, for the most part, these texts are written while they're, you know, subjugated to foreign powers. And the assumption in the Torah is that, you know, they're going to live in a mixed, you know, what we would consider a mixed political religious kingdom. You know, they would not have any conception of politics and religion separate. And you do see in wisdom, you do see a debate about, you know, to what extent the righteous are going to prosper, to what extent the wicked are going to prosper. And I don't think you do see a unitary answer to what we would call the problem of evil. You know, Proverbs is definitely the more optimistic in that the righteous will prosper. Job, you know, very clearly shows a righteous man suffering. You know, and in Ecclesiastes, kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, kind of takes a schizophrenic, you know, you see this guy having an internal debate with himself about, you know, what to do with life. And I do see that, you know, that is in the Bible. There is no, you know, for so much of, you know, especially in Mormonism, you know, the scriptures are treated as a textbook. You know, you go there, you read the proper line, you get the answer, you go home. Whereas, you know, for me, the Bible is more of a source book. It has to be read with wisdom. It has to be read in a tradition. It has to be read intelligently. Sometimes Proverbs does apply. Sometimes Job does apply. Sometimes Ecclesiastes does apply. And, you know, that is part of the wisdom tradition. You know, you learn these sayings, you learn these pithy proverbs, and it's not that they always and everywhere apply. It's that the wise man in their instance, it would have been, you know, wise man. But, you know, to be more inclusive, I'll say, you know, a wise man or a wise woman knows when they apply and how to apply them. So it's not saying, you know, it's not to give this unthinking final response. It is part of a debate. It's part of wisdom. It's part of thinking. It's part of living, you know, in this world that is unfair, that does have problems. And what do you do? You know, and that's the debate amongst those wisdom books.
So the question I have is what is your reaction? Okay, so the interesting thing about the book of Job, as a Mormon growing up, you think you're told the story. What you don't realize is that that's like the first three chapters and maybe the last one or two chapters is the fable. But in between is like 40-something chapters of dialogue. And they're basically going back and forth talking about the wisdom tradition, maybe challenging it. But what is your reaction to finally when Job begs for an audience with God because he thinks that he can show him that he was just? And then God shows up and just basically cowers him with like, where were you when I did this? Where were you when I did that? And he basically just shouts him down with a kind of a might makes right kind of answer. How do you respond to God answering Job in that way?
Yeah, I mean, that is one interpretation. An alternate interpretation, which I would favor, is it's not so much God, you know, telling Job, you know, shut up. But it's basically him giving examples. You know, I can't explain it. You're not at the level. You can't understand what I understand. You know, is that a valid? You know, does a modern person say, you know, that's the response I want? You know, no. But is there some truth in that? I mean, yeah. I don't think we can comprehend an infinite being. We can't. You know, we can't comprehend an infinite universe. And I think that is God. You know, and Israel saying, yeah, there is suffering, and we don't know. And we probably can't understand. I think that is, you know, the ultimate takeaway from the book of Job.
Well, I would argue that it's fairly clear that he's taking a dismissive sort of tone, that God is, that he's saying, who are you to speak? And that it isn't like a gentle, these things are too big for you. But it is, I am bigger than you, which is fine. But I do think that, you know, perhaps without the sort of intonation that Randy's giving it, that answer, please shut up, I'm much bigger than you, is kind of what's going on there. And I think that for a lot of people, that ends up just seeming like might makes right. And that seems to be a really pretty much, I think that's a hard to argue with sort of interpretation of Job.
Well, my feeling about it is that, you know, first of all, this is to me, I view this as the whole story of Job as an allegory, and we don't need to go into all the details of that. But I view that as the self-deprecation of somebody who is interpreting what God is teaching them. So, you know, a lot of people will say, you know, God told me this or God said that. What they're really saying is, this is what I feel like God is saying to me. And so I think that the end of Job sounds a lot more to me like somebody who is chiding themselves. And I've always believed that we're a lot harder on ourselves than God will ever be on us.
So the voice of God to you is not God himself, but Job?
In that particular story, yeah. But you know, once again, you guys are going to get different answers from me because I'm wishy-washy.
Come on, stop throwing that back in my face. We're going to edit. I guess we can't edit it out because you guys keep bringing it up.
Nah, I'm just messing with you, Randy.
Okay, so should we move on to the redemptive thread?
Yeah, go ahead and take that, Scott.
Okay, so this one's, I think, maybe is a little bit more straightforward, but this is basically the idea that that suffering can be redemptive, or that it can provide value. So some of the examples of this would be the story of Joseph in Egypt and his captivity, I guess the underlying narrative of Jesus, also, you know, Paul's story of suffering, that basically this these narratives can lead to a higher good, and that they can provide mechanisms by which the will of God is achieved, or by which a greater good takes place.
Yeah, and it's because a lot of modern people will talk about silver linings, and Bart Ehrman gives an example of that. You know, he got hepatitis. Do you guys remember the story in the book?
I can't remember the disease, but I don't know what you're talking about.
I think he got hepatitis the summer before his senior year, and he was kind of a meathead jock at the time. But he was on the debate team, but he really wasn't one of the prominent players. Well, he had all summer to just sit in his room, and you know, it led to him becoming, he studied really hard. He became a star of the debate team, and then he went on to be a scholar. And he talked about, you know, hey, I got hepatitis, which is a horrible thing to get, but it led to this other silver lining. But that's not the way Paul sees it. Like, Paul sees suffering as redemptive. Like, it's more than a silver lining. It's a requirement to come to a higher state of being. And so to me, that's the redemptive suffering thread or notion in the Bible is almost like suffering is a requirement.
It's like the idea of like the refiner's fire, or that you have to go through some great trial so that you can become a better person, essentially.
Right. But what it ignores is that most of the suffering in the world doesn't lead to a better place. It leads to destruction of people. Not only physically, but also emotionally, psychologically. A lot of probably the majority of the suffering in the world is crushing, not refining.
Yeah, and this is where I'm going to kind of throw in my evolutionary take on, or an evolutionary angle on the problem of evil, which is basically that if the mechanism by which life is created has built into it a certain error rate that causes, you know, things like birth defects or you know, these awful conditions that not just humans, but every species out there is born with. The reasons why we see the species that we have now is because over, you know, millions of years, there have been multiple, you know, factors of other organisms which died that weren't the ones that made it. So when I see speciation, this is something I brought up in the Meldrum interview that we did, which is when you consider the role of evolution and how that works, I guess this would kind of play into that maybe through that suffering, God created something as amazing as humans, or as amazing as, you know, this great variety of life. But how much suffering has to take place in order to have that, you know, beneficial result.
Yeah, nobody ever thinks about the suffering of Neanderthals.
Right. Yeah, exactly. like we have all these, you know, transitional time periods in which organisms were changing. Well, what about all the transitions that didn't ever transition into something else? Right? Like branches of the human tree that, you know, withered and died and just, you know, don't exist anymore. I mean, whole segments of what we would, I think, by any measure, call a civilization that have just been destroyed.
By the way, David just dropped off.
Well, that's unfortunate because I think he's really well informed and very intelligent. I mean, really two great guests. How are you going to cobble together a thing? I mean, he just drops out.
Yeah, what do you want to do, Randy?
No, we're finishing. We're pushing through, man. We've invested too much.
I mean, I am totally. You guys have done fantastic. Seriously, I really don't feel steamrolled. I don't. I have no issue continuing the discussion. I wish David was here, you know, just because he is very insightful and he is very well read.
Well, maybe we can do this, Randy. Maybe we can.
I'm still here. I took a potty break.
We thought you were leaving. We're all bummed out.
Okay.
Yes, and I have a question for you. Just I'd like to get it out with regard to this redemptive suffering, before you get too tired. Because
I need some redemption in myself.
Yes, well, redeem your. You actually are very, very well informed and articulate. So I'm really interested to hear your answer, and I want to hear Mike's too. But you know, we seem to be bringing together two different kinds of suffering. One is like Christ's redemptive suffering, right? And the necessity for that on the cross, the crucifixion, you know. And then the other is the sort of suffering that people often associate with, like, coming to learn, being purified personally, you know, being allowed to turn to Christ, whatever it is. But those seem to be two distinct but very important kinds of redemptive suffering within at least the Christian tradition.
I mean, one would be called the soul-making theodicy, you know, of Irenaeus. You know, the idea that people do get something out of suffering, that, you know, that suffering in a sense generates goodness, in that people respond to suffering, you know, and also the fact that, you know, suffering teaches, you know, patience and you know, humility and other Christian virtues. And I do see Christ's redemptive suffering as you know, a different category, you know, because his suffering is voluntary, you know, and this is one area where I do think that Mormonism and Christianity have a very different viewpoint. You know, under Mormonism, Jesus had to come down. He had to get a body. He was part of the plan. And, you know, Jesus really only exists to kind of get the crap kicked out of him on behalf of our sins. Whereas in the Christian view, it's a completely voluntary act. There's no need for Jesus to come down. You know, Colossians talks about the great emptying. You know, he empties himself out and comes down. And you know, his redemption is it's different. I will almost categorize it like you know, the great people who have you know, someone like Mother Teresa or better maybe Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr., you know, that when they go to suffer with other people, it's almost a sense of solidarity. You know, you could make the argument, I don't know that I would, that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. or Gandhi may have been, you know, they could have been more effective, quote unquote, had they not suffered with everybody. You know, had they stayed out of jail, they could have done more organizing. They could have made more phone calls or written more letters or whatever. But they choose to go suffer with the people whom they are in fight, you know, in fighting for. And I see Jesus suffering in a large way, you know, in that same way. He comes down to be one with us. He comes down to, redeem us, and be with us voluntarily. So I may have missed something, but I mean, that's how I would separate those two notions.
Okay. And I mean, I'm curious because, you know, you've got that self-emptying, right? The kenosis or whatever. You've also got this sense that, like, you get this in Paul and you get it in 1 Peter where, you know, he talks about how, you know, he didn't sin. He, you know, when he was abused, he didn't abuse in return. When he suffered, he didn't threaten anyone. I'm paraphrasing. But he handed himself over. He bore our sins, you know, in his body on the cross. He freed us from the sins. And so even if it was a voluntary self-emptying, right, to come down and suffer with us, he also had to suffer for us. And I'm just curious how both of you would interpret the necessity for that suffering.
I mean, necessary in the terms of absolute necessity, you know, it had to be that way. There was no other way. No, that's not the case. You know, God could have chosen any path to redeem humanity or chosen not to redeem humanity at all. That's simply the path that, you know, that God chose for redemption. And I guess if you're talking in terms of a concrete atonement theology, you know, is it an objective, you know, are we talking penal substitutionary atonement? Are we talking, you know, ransom theory? Are we talking Christus Victor? Are we talking, just a subjective, you know, Christ did this, so we need to follow him. I don't know that there is one, theory that covers them all. I would tend to favor a Christus Victor over something like a penal substitutionary atonement, though there definitely is that aspect of Christ being a substitute, you know, sacrifice on our behalf. Where was I going? Jeez.
No, that's
fading fast.
No, that's actually really interesting. I wonder what Mike thinks. I mean, there is the notion, like in Isaiah, you know, the suffering servant stuff, where he's wounded for our transgressions. But it sounds like what you're saying is that you would kind of favor this notion that it was kind of a triumph over sin, in very similar to the triumph over death, and so saved us from sin and death just through that suffering voluntarily.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I would lean towards that. Like I said, I don't think that the one. You know, these are all metaphors. These are all, you know, ways of approaching it. That's the metaphor I would choose, but I wouldn't begrudge someone who sees it more in a penal substitution or ransom theory, approach. That tends to mesh better with, you know, my inclinations and how I, you know, tend to read scripture.
Yeah, I agree with. I actually agree with David on that one.
Okay. Let's get to the last tradition, the apocalyptic tradition. It's a shame that why didn't the Maccabean books make it into the Bible? Anyone
know? They did. They did if you're Catholic or Eastern Orthodox.
Oh, really?
Yep. I have my Oxford Bible right here. I've read them. I like them. They're great books.
Okay.
Yeah, same here. Same here. I've enjoyed them.
So the Maccabean books tell the tale of how the Jews under the Persian, actually it was the Greek. Jim, was it the Greek? It was the generals of Alexander the Great.
It was basically a Hellenistic sort of thing. It's post Alexander, and they were trying to just force a sort of Hellenization on the Jews.
So they're trying to Hellenize the Jews. You cannot do that to the Jews. If one thing you can say about the Jews, they are stubborn.
Yeah, it would have been the Seleucid Empire under Antiochus Epiphanes would have been the context for that.
Thank you. But what started to happen was they became dissatisfied with the prophet or the wisdom tradition in explaining suffering, because they were suffering precisely because they were following the law. And so out of that grew the apocalyptic tradition. And then you have the pseudepigrapha of Daniel showing some signs of apocalypticism. Just spoiler alert, that wasn't written by Daniel. And then you, through the apocalyptic tradition, you have Jesus. And the the 4 points or the 4 aspects of apocalypticism outlined in the book. First is dualism. There's 2 cosmic forces in the world, evil and good. Second is pessimism, which you see today with global warming denialists, that man is incapable of fixing the problems of the world. Third is vindication. You'll be sorry. You'll be sorry when Jesus comes, or whoever your apocalyptic savior is, because it's not just the Jesus tradition that's apocalyptic. But we're talking about, with all apocalyptics, it's not just a pleasant cleansing. It is a gruesome cosmic smackdown of evil and non-believers, evil people and non-believers. And the fourth is imminence, which means it's just around the corner. Any day now, it's going to happen. You see that with quotes from Jesus, from Paul, from John, that you know, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. This generation shall not pass until these things shall occur. So,
Sidney Rigdon was a big fan of the apocalyptic tradition. Yeah. This is Sidney Rigdon written all over it. So
he was also a fan of the old prophets too. So it's kind of weird. But so how do you, Mike and David, view the apocalyptic tradition, and how does it influence your Christian belief?
I guess I'll go first. I will say I do think that I mean, I do have other issues with the way Ehrman's handled his reading of the Bible. I've kind of stayed silent because we've kind of glossed over a lot of this stuff. But I do think he draws too much of a contrast between the prophetic tradition and the apocalyptic tradition. You know, in scholarly circles, I think at least nowadays there's much more of a seeing of continuity between the two. You know, the other thing is, you know, when these prophets, you know, and the reason this is important is that, you know, the message of an apocalypse is, you know, very much in line with what the prophets had to say. You know, Abraham Herschel, who was a Jewish scholar, you know, he said the prophets were unpleasant people because they saw the world as having so much more potential than it had. And that's one of the reasons they railed so strenuously, was because their vision of what could be and, you know, what Jesus would call the kingdom of God was so much more than we would allow it to be. And I think in the apocalyptic visions, what you see is you see people attempting to paint that with very vivid images, very vivid, you know, not meant to be taken literally. You know, I don't see how you can take, you know, the vision of dragons with 10 heads with horrors riding on them as being a literal, you know, this is going to happen. And I think it's them saying, you know, this is the vision of God's kingdom. This is the consequence of sin. This is the this is the possibility of the kingdom of God. You know, you see that in the apocalypse, you know, the book of Revelation with the New Jerusalem. You know, the idea, this is the kingdom of God. And it's also, you know, it is a, you know, condemnation of how we, you know, handle the world today. You know, just, you know, to take one example, you know, the book of Revelation and, you know, like in the, what's that series, the Left Behind, you know, it's so much about, you know, what's going to happen, you know, in this predictions, but it's more about, you know, to use a kind of a trite phrase, it's forthtelling, not foretelling. You know, you see people trafficking in other people. You see greed. You see avarice. You see, you know, sexual morality. And you see men and, you know, people just behaving treating other people like crap. And you know, saying the book of Revelation, you see, you know, whoever wrote the book of Revelation, I'll just call him John because that's the traditional ascription. You know, he's railing against that. He's saying this is not the way it should be. This is the possibility, guys. And, you know, in kind of this fit of prophetic ecstasy, you see all these visions. You see, you know, it's him saying, you know, I can't put this into words, so I'm just going to paint pictures, and you're going to have to draw the conclusions. So, you know, that's how I tend to see the apocalyptic apocalyptic tradition more, more in terms of, I do see, you know, there is dualism, there is pessimism, but I do see a fundamental optimism and a fundamental possibility that you also see in the prophets. And I don't think Ehrman draws that out. Anyway, I'll be quiet now.
Well, let me try. I want to respond to that because I actually think you're right in the sense that there's a closer connection between the prophetic tradition and the apocalyptic traditions. But I think that's to the discredit of the prophetic tradition. And that is the prophetic imagination in these apocalypses ends up getting elevated to cosmic principles. You've got these forces that are just basically, you know, pervading the cosmos. You've got this good and evil and all that sort of stuff. But especially among apocalypses, John's is maybe the most macabre. And most people think that I've read, most of the scholars that I read think that it isn't quite as allegorical as you're saying. I mean, he really expects convulsions of this magnitude. He expects suffering of this magnitude. When he says, "I'm going to spew you out of my mouth if you're lukewarm," he really means it. It's really a gruesome vision. And when you compare it to, like, say, some of the Jewish apocalypses, like, I don't know, 4th Ezra or 2nd Baruch or something like that, really those have, like, you know, an element of lamentation. They have perspective. But I think John of Patmos, or whatever you want to call him, really is capable of imagining gruesome violence, grisly violence at a cosmic level. And that the optimism is the sort of optimism of, and the enemies will see, and they'll be trampled underfoot. And, you know, I fervently wish that it was the last one accepted into the canon. I wish it had been left out. It would have been a lot better for humanity. I mean, I think the apocalyptic tradition in the form of John's revelation is really, it expresses some of the worst aspects of humanity when it comes to dealing with their sense of their enemies. And the desire for vindication. I mean, that's one where I feel really strong. In fact, when I left the Mormon Church, as much as anything, much more than like polyandry and stuff like that, it was really the New Testament that did it for me as much as the Book of Mormon. I didn't really care much about Mormon history. It was actually, the Book of Revelations was pretty crappy.
I mean, the way I would respond to that is, I mean, I see where you're coming from. One of the issues in interpreting something like the apocalypse is when does the allegory stop and when does the reality begin? Because, I mean, no matter how literalist somebody says they are, they're never going to interpret all of Revelation literally. You know, just to take the example you just said, you know, "I'm going to spew you out of my mouth." I mean, that's obviously allegory because, there, you know, God doesn't have a literal mouth that people are being, you know, spat out of. You know, so one issue is, you know, where does the allegory be, you know, stop and where does reality begin? You know, and there are gruesome images. You know, what I would argue is that, you know, John does see a gruesome reality. He does see, he sees humanity. He sees us in all of our, you know, evilness. He sees slave trafficking. He sees, you know, all of the realities of, you know, of living in the Roman Empire, especially out in the provinces. And he's, you know, he's saying, you know, this is not the way it should be. And he, you know, he does say that the remedy is, you know, is going to be divine. Now, how you interpret all of these graphic images, that's going to determine whether you think, you know, this is, you know, God's vengeance coming, you know, with, you know, in full throttle, or if it's, sorry, go on.
Well, I mean, I would say, I mean, no one interprets all of it literally in the sense of like, okay, there's really, you know, a mouth that's going to be spewing people out. But I have yet to see anyone, you know, any scholar anywhere not take it very, very literally in the sense that there is this expected massive convulsion. And yes, John sees this horrible Roman Empire that's doing all of these horrible things, and he's persecuting the, you know, the flock and everything like that. But what he does is that he ups it unimaginably. I mean, he out-Romes Rome. It's like he out-Herod's Herod. He out Hitler's Hitler in his imagination. And no one has ever read it that I've seen where it isn't like he literally expects there to be a massive destructive horrible convulsion that makes Roman violence, you know, wimpy in comparison.
So that's odd because, I mean, the scholars, you know, I've really only listened to, you know, in depth one scholar's view of it, and his was not that view. I think his name's Craig Evans.
Yeah, no, you'll get some people recently, you know, who who are like uncomfortable with the violence. I mean, that's but usually what'll happen is you know you go into the footnotes and you're like, well, you don't have to take it like this. It's traditionally been taken like this, but you could read it like that if you want to. And what you get is the squeamishness of the scholar, but really, you know, the power of the vision is very hard to gainsay. And, you know, the capacity of imagining gruesome, grisly destruction of your enemies. I mean, like, one scholar I was just reading yesterday, he was like, you know, he certainly lost perspective here, didn't he? And it says, I'm quoting this one, "The most one can say in defense of such an action is that the author certainly must have been serious about his commitments. The rest is loss of perspective and grisly. It's simply macabre." That's a Bible scholar, right?
Can I just jump in? David and Mike, do you each believe in a literal second coming of Jesus?
Yes, but I would identify myself as a millenarian, so if that helps.
Okay.
Yeah, I do believe in a literal second coming. I view the entire book of Revelation and the really a lot of the more dogmatic views of apocalyptic viewpoints as allegory. I think it's pretty clear, actually, wouldn't you say, Jimmy, when you look at it, that it is the book of Revelation, it's a vision, all the constructs in there, like beasts and other things, are clearly allegory. So, because I've been, you know, I'm well read in a lot of not just modern day Christian theologians, but Christian theologians from the past who would say, no, this entire book of Revelation is an allegory. And so I'm not sure who you're talking about.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by allegory. I mean, you know, that you don't have like some one-to-one representation, like, you know, such and such as faith and such as, you know.
Hold on, Jimmy.
Okay.
Are you still moving or something?
No, but I can repeat myself. Mine do.
Yeah, your audio sounds terrible.
Well, it's there's all this background noise. I don't know if you're like around or.
I am not actually moving at all.
Maybe that's not it.
Alright, go ahead.
How does it sound like? Okay.
Well, sometimes I hear this. Sometimes I hear this.
I don't know what.
And
that
it's driving me crazy because I like what you're saying.
So what I want to say is that, you know, when you have something that is not to be taken literally, I don't think it's an allegory, at least technically speaking, but it's a vision, right? Like Mike said, and it's a vision that has this sort of like it's like got this sort of fantastic element to it. And you're not like looking at a movie of what's going to be happening, right? But it's pretty clear what the allegory is of. And it's an allegory of cosmic forces coming into contact in a tremendous and gruesome battle. And it's an allegory of suffering of tremendous proportions for the people that are on the wrong side. It's an allegory of vindication against those people. And it's grisly and gruesome. And in comparison to other apocalypses of the same era, you know, you can get a sense of its whole ethos. And so, you know, that sort of waving your hand and allegorizing stuff doesn't take away that sort of violent, cosmic, self-vindicating, tremendous violence of this book. And so, yeah, you can always say something's an allegory, but, you know, when it's clearly an allegory of tremendous cosmic destruction of your enemies, you know, that doesn't come from the best place in human nature.
Well, let me, you make very, very good points. And I just want to address what I mean, because I can see how it would come across that I'm just waving my hand every time and saying, you know, oh, well, that's allegory. I don't take it literal. And I don't mean it in that sense. Let me be a little bit more specific. If I were to say to you, man, when he did that to me, it ripped my heart out. That's a pretty violent statement. And we all know it's an allegory. We know that he didn't walk up to me and, you know, like in some of the gruesome movies, stick his, you know, fist through my chest and rip my heart out. It's just describing anguish to the most bitter nth degree. And so what I'm saying is, couldn't it be possible that the destruction and some of the more hideous aspects are allegorical in the same way? It's not literally that, people's hearts will be ripped out, but that's what it will feel like to people who reject God. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I do have an answer to that. I mean, it's closer, in my opinion, given the entire outlook and ethos of it, to, say, a really intensely, dangerously abusive parent saying, I am going to rip your heart out, and I'm going to flay you. And he doesn't flay you. He doesn't rip your heart out. He beats the hell out of you. And he punishes you in a way that's unimaginably hard and has no connection to any sort of thing you could have conceivably done. And yeah, he literally did not flay you. He literally did not rip your heart out. He just did horrible, horrible things. And that is the sort of imagination that's at the root of this. I don't think it's a salvageable imagination in terms of any sort of standpoint of ethics or, you know, the best parts of the human spirit.
Well, for me, it is when, you know, when you're talking about situations that are totally hideous, like, you know, child trafficking and other terrible, terrible things. You know, you see words from Jesus talking about a millstone hung around your neck and buried in the ocean. I think any of us feel that way that have children. You know, I think about my three kids. If I had, you know, if my beautiful little almost 4-year-old daughter were to be hurt in any way intentionally by someone else, I would want some serious justice. And to me, that's actually the manifestation of a loving parent who says, hey, I'm talking about the people who are insidiously causing suffering because of their just intense immoral viewpoints, and how they interact with people are just awful and terrible. Those are the people where justice would say, okay, now you need to feel what you're inflicting on other people, or you will never understand what you did. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't persuade me. It's not really close. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the revelation comes from kind of a gruesome imagination, and that there are other ways of dealing with the insidiousness of the Roman culture, all of its, you know, horrific elements and all that sort of stuff.
So I have a question for Mike and David. Maybe this could kind of be a closing question. What is your vision of the Second Coming? Like, what kind of things are going to happen in your mind? What's the scope? If there's any destruction, what's the scope of the destruction? What do you see in the Second Coming?
Well, a lot of the, you know, as you read the prophecies on the preparation for the Second Coming, a lot of it is natural disaster, right?
Does your God control that?
I believe he allows it to happen. I don't believe that God is actually causing an earthquake and causing a hurricane and causing... I believe he allows it to happen. This is actually part of where my faith in God and my strong foundation in science come together. Because whenever I study science and look at it from a beginning to end perspective, that actually continues to increase my faith in a designer. Because as we're looking at some of the current science, we're seeing that the earth and the atmosphere and the solar system and the sun and all these things are getting older. They're aging and there seems to be an expiration date. Well, if there's an expiration date, then to me, that naturally leads to some sort of beginning. And I have a hard time grasping an uncaused cause. I have a hard time grasping something coming out of nothing. And that's a whole other discussion, but it increases my faith. And what does this have to do with the second coming? I think it's just the natural unfolding of what happens to an earth that God created that is finite. This is not an infinite earth. And it makes his sovereignty and his power and his eternal nature that much more incredible. You know, in Mormonism, God always was a God with a small g, and he was obtained, you know, you could eventually become like him. In Christianity, you can't become like him. He's way too, there's too big of a chasm between us. And I think having us here on a finite earth, we will see the natural succession of what happens when an earth expires, which is going to increase temperature. It's going to create more tornadoes, more hurricanes, and all these things to demonstrate his power. And then to show us from an eternal perspective, his mercy. And so I see all those things as natural things that God allows to happen in order for us to truly understand his power, who he is, and really jolt a lot of us. I mean, all of us have pride issues. All of us have things that we need to change. All of us have things that cause us to be a little bit hard of heart. And I think that it's a real humbling thing. It's amazing what happens naturally to humanity when things go wrong from a natural perspective. Because if you're, you know, unless you're one of those people who thinks that God causes a hurricane, most people don't think that. So they just come together and they say, this is a disaster that is, and we're going to come together and we're going to help each other. And some of the best of humanity happens after disasters come through. And I think that we'll see more and more of that. And as the scriptures prophesy, and then God will ultimately come and literally put an end to it. And that's where my literal nature comes. That's what I believe.
So wait, how specific are these disasters going to be? I mean, are they, a lot of the Christian tradition is the righteous will be protected from these disasters and the wicked won't. Do you see it that way? Are these hurricanes and these tsunamis, are they going to be selective on who they kill, or does it not really matter?
No, because, I mean, you read Matthew and Jesus answered the question, the rain falls on the righteous and the unrighteous, the just and the unjust. And, you know, I think it's actually kind of a simplistic notion to think that let me go back, the Mormon construct of what's righteous and what's not and what's worthy and what's not is just fundamentally flawed. I don't understand how anyone could claim to be more worthy or more righteous or less, you know, that type of stuff is hard to differentiate to me unless you're God. And so obviously God is going to, you know, we already see that all these things happen to people no matter what. And you and I, since I'm not God and I don't know that, I don't know anyone who could give me a definitive answer after each disaster. Did this tornado rip through the home of righteous people or unrighteous people? Is this hurricane destroying, you know, 50% righteous people and 50% unrighteous? I think at the end of the day, it doesn't matter from that perspective. Now, it matters because I don't want to diminish the suffering, but I do want to emphasize the redemptive nature, because that the redemptive nature of what, you know, I can't talk about the apocalyptic tradition without talking about the redemptive nature of what Jesus has to offer. To me, they go hand in hand.
Yeah, but I mean, if you read John, it sounds like it's very specific that he's going to, you know, this is a redemptive thing. The evil will be punished, and the righteous will be redeemed, and it's going to be gruesome for the evil. But what you described was just willy-nilly disasters everywhere. Everyone comes together, then Jesus comes. I just it doesn't seem like they go hand in hand. It almost seems like a postmodern interpretation based on your own current social mores and morality, trying and sensibilities, trying to reconcile what is actually in the Bible.
Well, now that morality comes from Jesus's words. I mean, we can cherry pick the New Testament and point out a few of the things that that don't sound like they match what I'm saying, but Jesus is very clear in multiple sermons that he gives that are recorded in the New Testament that, for example, saying things like pray for, don't just pray for people who have that you love, pray for the wicked as well. And, and I'm talking about all those narratives. I think that we sometimes in this discussion of the problem of suffering ignore that we also have the problem of good and I say problem in quotes, but it's equally as valid to discuss why do we have good? Why do we have redemptive nature all throughout the history of time? Why are all these things happening? And I think that when you read the entire Bible from start to finish, it's not very far off for me to have that viewpoint of how the whole thing unfolds.
Yeah, Stephen Law talks about that. He talks about solving the problem of evil by positing that God is evil, and now you have to deal with the problem of good. But David, what is your vision of the Second Coming?
I go to United Methodist Church, and United Methodist, like most Christian denominations in the United States, and really don't talk about the Second Coming much at all. It's not a subject for sermons. It's not something that people really even care that much about. That's probably odd for Mormons who grew up like in the 80s, like I did, where it seemed like every second lesson in Sunday school was on the Second Coming. It's just not talked about or discussed. I mean, there is the line in the Apostles' Creed, which we say each Sunday, that Jesus will come to judge the quick and the dead. And that's probably about as much as your average Methodist even knows or cares about the Second Coming. I mean, it's there. We believe it's going to happen. I mean, for me, it's a distant hope of righting of wrongs, of the new heavens and the new earth, coming together, for specifics of destructions and, which hurricane's going to hit which coast. And, I don't know. I honestly really haven't thought much about it, which is actually one of the things I enjoy about not being a Mormon is most people just don't care.
Well, so I have to say that the hardest part, becoming an atheist, the hardest thing for me to give up was the notion of justice for the evil. Like, Hitler dies and he doesn't have to account for any of that shit he did. 50 million people dead because of that guy. So I can empathize with the desire for cosmic justice. But what about you and Scott and Jimmy?
Well, for me on that, I almost look at it the other way. Like, for me, it was a big relief to kind of realize that this world is what we have, and that the concept of cosmic justice, or that there's some kind of eternal balancing of the scales. I just think more from a humanist perspective that we have to take responsibility for what's happening here. So if we can take responsibility for it and do something as humans by, you used the example of Hitler, but if there's a, if there's a regime, or if there's people that are out in the world that are causing suffering, I think that as humans, we have a responsibility to take action against that. And so I guess in a way it sort of justifies some of the atrocities that have happened by taking that view, if that makes sense. Or at least it doesn't justify the atrocities. It justifies humans taking actions to help prevent those sorts of things, which can end up being problematic at times. But
hang on. Did I hear you right? Sorry, I'm really losing it.
No, I'm probably not making sense. So
No. No, you said something, and this is interesting, because from when I've talked to most atheists, they won't go this route. You said you've given up redemption of evil, or what aspect of evil did you give up as an atheist, that there won't be a punishment for it, but that objective evil exists? Or is it just that there's no objective evil, so it doesn't really, you know, because in that sense, Hitler won't be punished because there's nothing, you know, there's nothing objective to punish him or
no,
do
no,
away
no.
with him.
No, I'm not saying that. I mean, I'm a materialist. I don't think that after Hitler dies, there's nothing left to punish. I mean, if he's dead, there's no. I mean, he couldn't receive eternal punishment or anything like that because there's no evidence to support that there's anything eternal about Hitler. So I don't have any kind of view. There's no view on terms of eternal punishment. But I think what Randy was saying is that it's like, oh, it's too bad that we can't punish Hitler post-mortem because what he did was, you know, so much worse than the punishment that he got here on Earth. And I'm saying, for me, it's a relief to know that when we do punish people here, that we can own that and we can take responsibility for it. Because okay. We're not leaving it up to God. We're not going to say, you know, we're going to, you know, turn the other cheek if someone smites you. That doesn't need to be the case.
So you're saying it empowers you, or
yeah, exactly. It empowers humanity, and it should lead us all to take some responsibility for it instead of just passing it off to God and saying, well, you know, those people are going to get theirs in the end because they're not.
So Jimmy was. I know we've talked about this many, many times, but was that hard for you to let go like it is for me? You know, because I'm the kind of person, if somebody cuts in line, I want justice right now. You know, I'm all it's deep inside me.
And I agree with that.
An aversion to just injustice in the world. But was it hard for you to let go of that, Jimmy?
For me, it really never was an issue. I never really had a strong conviction in the idea that cosmic justice would happen. It just kind of seemed natural. I mean, the idea that there's meaningless suffering, there's gratuitous suffering, that the wicked sometimes prosper and all that just seemed to be a fact. And, you know, it was not any relief to find out or to come fully to the belief that, you know, it's not going to be taken care of. And that, you know, the only relief was just kind of intellectual. It's like, now I can move on and I can start addressing in my mind how to respond to suffering now that I don't have to try to get cosmic justice into the picture. You know, and I mean, this is an issue I've thought about and thought about and thought about, but the sort of thoughts that I've come to since then are really way beyond the scope of what we're doing here. But I do want to say this, that I'm always very, very, very worried and anxious when I hear someone who wants to take meaningless suffering or apparently meaningless suffering and come up with a meaning for it. Because usually what that means is the suffering gets minimized. It gets put into an eternal perspective. The terrible doesn't get treated in its full terribleness. And in certain ways, being able to acknowledge the meaninglessness of certain suffering is a way of accepting its gravity. Sometimes you will fuck up at such a level that there is no remediation. And that doesn't please me, but it makes me take suffering much more seriously than someone does who thinks that, well, in the end, this will be taken care of. And so, you know, I think that most of us really hate suffering, but really, you know, meaningful suffering actually is something that we can bear. And sometimes we'll project meaning onto suffering to make it bearable, but we minimize it when we do it. And so that's where I've come.
Yeah, very well said. I like that a lot.
Thank you.
And Jimmy, I actually resonate with what you say, and it does bother me when people will use any sort of belief system to minimize suffering. I don't think that Christians are the only ones that do that, and I see that often. But once again, I have to come back to my response is quite opposite when I put it in the context of Jesus and the teachings of the New Testament, where he actually, in that construct that David is talking about, where he chooses to come and suffer and experience as God every single suffering that we all will suffer so that he can succor his people. I think that once again, whenever you have experienced that suffering, it gives you a unique perspective on how to succor people, how to comfort, and it actually does it's not a minimizing of it. It's minimizing if we say, oh, well, what you're going through right now is just going to pass, and just know in the eternities you'll be taken care of. I agree, that minimizes it. But if we followed what Jesus taught, and this is why I embrace Christianity, is he says, no, mourn with those that mourn, comfort those that stand in need of comfort, because we're all going to suffer. He says it, that we all experience suffering. We'll all have burdens, and we'll all have things that we'll face in this life from multiple angles. And in fact, I think he does quite the opposite of minimizing the suffering. I think what he's saying is this suffering is so crucial to eternity, the redemptive nature, all these things we're talking about, that I'm going to come and experience it myself. And when you experience it, it's going to cause you to be even more understanding, more empathic. And I have the opposite effect. Just because I believe that there'll be a redemptive vindication after this life does not minimize my desire to comfort those people who are suffering.
Well, you know, for me, it seems like Jesus comes too late. And really, he's not necessary to feel like empathetic. For example, if you come from, say, a Buddhist point of view, and there are some Buddhists that are atheists. Well, they're all atheists, but there are some that are very naturalist that, you know, speak about compassion, but they don't even have to address the fact that there's some supposed being that isn't being compassionate like we're being asked to be compassionate. In other words, it seems like Jesus is both unnecessary and belated and negligent. And so for me, you know, it was kind of a relief not to have to make some sort of account of why Jesus doesn't come. And of course, I never felt like I had to give up sympathy or love or compassion because that's, you know, that's a fundamental human possibility that I really embrace. And so that's kind of where I stand, at least.
I mean, I'll just say, you know, the problem of evil is the best argument against God, and it is the one that causes me the most thought. So for me, this is the hardest thing that a believer in God has to deal with. The duty of a Christian isn't to minimize suffering or to try and explain it away or to try to, you know, in a sense, say it doesn't matter or anything like that. I think the Christians, what a Christian has to do is take a very, you know, realistic look at the world, realize that there is evil, and realize that, you know, any solution to the problem of evil, and I wish we had gotten, it seemed like we had bounced back and forth between, you know, more technical philosophical responses to evil and more biblical responses. You know, that, you know, there's an aspect, you know, of the problem of evil, you know, called the emotional problem of evil. And that's a problem for atheists and for believers alike. It's just the fact that, you know, things suck, and that causes all kinds of emotional problems for the person experiencing it and for the person who, you know, looks on at it. And as a Christian, for the emotional aspect of evil, that's kind of where the rubber hits the road. That's where I think atheists and Christians can pull together and say, okay, what can we do? What can we do to actually fix the suffering as much as we can? I think a realistic assessment of humanity is that that's never ever going to be completely taken care of. There's always going to be evil. There's always going to be natural disasters. There's always going to be meaningless suffering. But that's, you know, dealing with it is not something that only the believer could do, or, you know, nobody has a monopoly on it. And that for the more, you know, philosophical problems of evil, I think that, you know, there are good philosophical explanations as to why evil exists in the world, you know, what purpose it has. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, theodicies, which we didn't get into, free will defenses and soul making defenses, and, you know, on and on and on. But that, you know, for a Christian, There are explanations, and it is going to involve a certain amount of mystery. Ultimately, the explanation is going to have to, you know, involve, at least in some way, maybe totally, you know, the life and death of Jesus Christ. And, you know, for a Christian, I think that, you know, because this is the most difficult problem, you know, we have to approach it with a certain sense of humility and not to dismiss the problem. I think both sides, you know, have their issues where it's hard for that side to deal with it. You know, whether atheists have their issues that are hard to deal with, Christians have this issue, have this issue and others, and this is just the hardest. And I think both sides have to say, you know, I'm not just going to dismiss it and pretend it doesn't exist. You know, since before the Christian, that is the problem of evil. We have to say it exists, and it is a very difficult problem for us to deal with. And, you know, just don't, you know, don't be flippant about it. You know, take it seriously. You know, all aspects of the problem of evil, you know, the logical problem of evil, the you know, the probabilistic, you know, problem of evil. You know, is there a reason God would allow suffering? You know, in practical terms, you know, focus on the concrete realities of evil, you know, in the world today. You know, that's my final thoughts. I know I'm kind of rambling.
So you don't subscribe to the pessimism that we can't fix problems.
I think to a certain degree we can fix some problems. I do think that you know human history is just replete with wars and bloodshed, and you know there's really not much of a sign of abatement. You know, of that, you know, we happen to live in a pretty cushy corner of the world, so I think we tend to lose sight of the fact that you know other stuff is happening. You know, there's kind of this paradox of, we have to go out and try and remedy the world of evil, but at the same time realize that it's realistically, what's the likelihood of that happening? Probably nil. And that, you know, that is ultimately, you know, where Jesus Christ, you know, does come in. You know, if there is going to be a final justice, if there is going to be, you know, if this is a just universe, there's going to have to be something other than just ourselves. That's going to have to make it just. I mean, even if today we could eliminate every single evil, that doesn't make up for the injustices that have happened in the past.
Yeah.
So,
that's a good point.
You know, in that sense, if there is going to be a just universe, something other than ourselves is going to have to tip the scales in the direction of goodness and justice and beauty and love and all those, you know, good things.
Of course, that's a really big if.
No, it is an if, but you know, that is, you know, in my mind, one of the essences of the Christian faith is that God exists, that God came down and suffered, and yes, it is faith. You know, there's no doubt about that. But that is the hope. That's the faith. That's the hope that it will happen.
So, Mike, David gave his closing remarks. So you're very well versed on giving closing remarks. So what are your what are yours?
Well, first I want to say you can see why I wanted David to come on board. Very, very articulate, very well read, and very few things that I disagree with from what I heard here. And so I just appreciate what he said. I'm sad that that last part got cut off for me, but I'm sure whatever's on there I'll hear. But I appreciate that. And there's a lot that he said that I resonate with. I guess all I want to conclude with a couple of thoughts about just this general coming out of Mormonism and trying to figure out what's true and what's not. And for me, I actually went through a phase where I felt like I was leaning agnostic, starting to become atheist. And it was on the crux of this issue of the problem of suffering and just the hideous stuff that exists in the world. So I want to make that clear that when I try to grasp these issues, it is it's heart-wrenching, and I think that there's a tendency to be emotional, and I felt like it was me being more emotional than anything else when I was leaning more agnostic or atheist. And as I kept coming back and trying to understand the Bible from a non-Mormon perspective, from an ex-Mormon perspective, and see that there's a lot of other interpretation. Mormonism has only scratched the surface of the Bible for 184 years, whereas we have theologians that have been studying the Bible for hundreds of years, and you can glean a lot of wisdom. And to me, that helped me start to come to some of these answers. All the stuff that is talked about in this book, God's problem, if you take each one and try to universalize them, that's where I think I started to fall into pitfalls and say, you know what, if I say that the prophetic tradition that suffering is the consequence of sin, then that's the answer to all suffering. That's just a silly notion, because there's a lot of cases where that isn't the answer. But if I look at each one, to me, the answer is all of the above and maybe some things that we still don't understand.
Rampant discrimination, mass poverty, third world debt, infectious disease, global inequality, and deepening socioeconomic divisions. Well, it does in your brain. We call upon the author to explain.
Hi, this is Hillary.
Matthew Ryan.
Carol.
Keith.
Dashley.
And I like to play bingo online while listening to Infants on Thrones.
You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com.
And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes.
I did.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
Rain, and we call upon the author to explain.
David, man, you are awesome. If all Christians were like you, the world would be a better place. America certainly would be.
Well, that's good to hear.
I don't know what percentage. I mean, because you just see so much the loudness of the voice of the conservative right, trying to legislate things like intravaginal ultrasounds on women who want abortions and putting creationism into classrooms. All that stuff just makes me so angry. But then I meet Christians like you and Mike, and I'm just like, yeah. It gives me a dose of reality instead of the kind of obscured, cartoonish caricature that I get from watching Jon Stewart.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that, for the most part, you know, there is a caricature out there, and it may be reflective of the majority. I don't know. I haven't taken a tally, but it is what it is. You know, I do try and be thoughtful, and I try and approach things, you know, with reason, with hope, with faith, you know, all that tied into one. But yeah, you know, it, what I say doesn't make good copy, you know, in all honesty, because nobody wants to hear it.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.